This week we'll continue the discussion of the American way of life as America's common religion. Overarching commitment, the overarching system of meaning and value that defines the American understanding of itself. And this way we hope to do two things. We hope to see more closely, examine more closely what in terms of what Americans do, in fact, define their meaning and value. And we also hope to see the relation between this common religion of Americans, this overarching faith, as some people, some writers call it, to the conventional or professed religions in both directions. And I'll point out later on, the American way has itself been molded by our religious heritage. On the other hand, it has refashioned the conventional religions of American society. Now, I go back to this briefly. On the spiritual side, I pointed out the American way. First, and basically a firm belief in the Supreme Being, it is strongly idealistic, so it idealizes everything. Everything has to be in terms of pursuit of an ideal, and on the other side, everything has to be either good or bad. So that whatever we are compelled to do by circumstances, we obsessively idealize. When we were compelled to enter into alliance with Soviet communism, with Stalin against Hitler, it didn't take 24 hours before Stalin appeared to be a benevolent old grandfather in the American mind. Whereas a week before, he was a devil, and a week later, he'd be a devil again, as he was. But Americans could conceive of an alliance with anyone who was a good man. Therefore, they have been compelled to idealize, or on the other side, what we call it, demonize, in line with the moralistic, idealistic grade of American thought feeling. Now, I don't want to go into what this does to any realistic foreign policy, but it certainly doesn't help. Well, what it does to American religion, we'll see. So the second point is idealism, moralism, the supreme value of the individual, which every American understands is a part of America's message to the world. The supreme value of the individual, a strong individualism, which has had tremendous impact on religion in America. Then, this belief in brotherhood, that's the point I left off last week. Now, for the American brotherhood, is in turn as coming recently to signify the unity of all Americans. Now, it is the word that corresponds to the familiar phrase, after all, we're all Americans. Now, that doesn't mean Americans don't deal kindly with other people. As I pointed out, they're the givingest nation on earth. But there it's concern for the underprivileged or for those who are in misfortune, whether these are inside our country or outside. If they're not confident in the unity of American life, there is no sense of this kind of real solidarity. You see what I mean? Now, don't mistake me. Americans are not a hard heart, they're very soft hearted. But the attitude is quite different to those who are within the American consensus, within the brotherhood of all Americans, and those who are outside. In fact, the actual practice may seem paradoxical. Americans are far more ready to help. As I pointed out, final distress and American distress. Simply because the final distress, what a privilege. They touch their heart, a kind of charity. But American distress, first of all, there was a Pusa, second of all, why couldn't they have made out the way we make out, you know? They're far more generous to foreign distress, whether found in America or outside, than to Americans in distress. And of course, there's a good sense in that, too, because Americans in this, our system has become so institutionalized that there's even a whole technology of distress areas, you know. You see a point? Yes?
Does the economic underprivileged aspect of those people living in slum areas change the average American view toward them?
As a matter of fact, that's a good question. Whether there were such people, today, for most Americans, they're not visible anywhere. There may be 10% of American people who are underprivileged today. But when there were a lot, they were on a large scale. But in the free affluent state of American society, these people were treated exactly as I described, as underprivileged charity cases, whom they had to be kind. Who were those who started settlement houses, who started church settlement houses, church reclamation projects? Not the denomination made up of the lower middle class people, although they like the Baptists and Methodists. On the contrary, the Episcopalian started, the Presbyterian started, with a sense of helping our weaker neighbor, you see, a noblesse oblige. And they felt exactly the same way for these people in the slum who were generally, of course, also farmers. Remember, I'm talking about 30, 40, 50 years ago, who were generally farmers who had not yet become Americans. It's exactly the way I described. And that's the source of the social welfare programs of the churches, which came first with the rich churches, not the poor churches.
Well, I was wondering if today there were a correspondence between being in an underprivileged area and being looked upon as foreign.
That's right, there is faith. But you see, it's not very common. It's not visible today for Americans. The great mass of middle-class Americans, and the great mass of Americans are middle-class, hardly have contact with what you might call substandard life, you know? And when they hear about it the same way as foreigners or Negroes of come north or something like that, vaguely, in a vague sort of way, or obviously not our kind of people, you see? And the appeal there is to charity and to a good heart, to noblesse oblige, you know, to the responsibility of their well-being and power rather than to the solidarity of Americans.
Well, let me phrase my question backwards. To be American, does that mean to be
that's right.
Economically?
It means to be middle class. Being an American is to be middle class. Now, middle class is a vast term. It goes all the way from the lower middle class to the upper middle class. I'm talking about 65% of the American population. But it means to be middle class and not look at aspirations in values. Well, I'm not very illustrated, although I'll get to it later on. Take in Roy Warner's stratification scheme, the upper, the lower upper, the upper middle, the lower middle, the lower and the upper lower and the lower upper. Now, this is a pretty precise scheme. You don't get it by asking what are, you don't have to say lower. But what is the distinction between the lower and the rest? Not so much the power of their life, although for the lower and the upper lower are both live in penurious conditions, hard conditions. But that the lower don't care. And that excludes from American concern, from American consensus, from American data. They're now derelict cases, you see, charity cases. When a teacher who visits the parent of a child doing poorly in school and tells the mother says, "So what do I care?" That immediately puts the mother outside the American consent for the teacher, you see. She's a strange case. Foreigner, something wrong. It's the middle class aspirational value that defines, you see. A proper example I'm going to discuss the class structure of Protestants in America. Now, finally, the fifth point, the sixth point I want to mention in this, of the American way on the spiritual side, is the high valuation of religion. Now, this is really one of the most important aspects of the American way, the extraordinary high valuation of religion. And I've already discussed that in so many different contexts, I want to emphasize. Notice that we begin with the belief of supreme being and go all the way down to high valuation of religion. One of the ways you can tell America in Europe is by a high valuation of religion. Americans will, in Scandinavian countries, will be shocked at the fact that the churches are empty. The churches are generally empty week to week. About 5% of the church members should ever come to their services. In America, it's at least 40%. Not more. I don't. If you take somebody, the people who come at some time or other, it's nearly 80%. But regularly, about 40%. Americans are shocked at this. And Europeans, I can't understand, are surprised, gratified, or chagrined, whatever, by the high valuation of religion in the American mind. Now, this is the glory testifying on the glory. Any questions? Now, we want to get to the ethos of the American way. Ethos is the brain of the American way, the structural character of the American way. When I illustrate this, you'll see what I mean. The American way is dynamic. The great drive of the American way is to get ahead, self-improvement. Now, of course, this is kind of common, this is characteristic also of parts of Western Europe. But today, it rather comes back from America to Western Europe, although it came to America from our Western Europe. And then they call it European Americanization. When the French peasant doesn't want to live on the land, on a tiny bit of scrubby land forever, because it's great, because his ancestors were there when Charlemagne was around, that's called Americanization. Now, this dynamic character of American life is so obvious to us, and seems to us like can't be any other way. But only if you contrast with other modes of life, you see the difference. This drive to get ahead, for self-improvement, is so characteristic of America that it's not called America. The second feature is the optimistic character of the American way. Americans have an unshakable belief that all problems are solvable, that they solve all problems. Now, this is worth a moment of thought. In the American mind, especially in the 20th century, all problems have become technological problems. Now, a technological problem is in principle solvable. And all you need to solve a technological problem is what? Something like the problem, what do you need? Knowledge. And skill, law, based on knowledge. And there's a straight line move from the problem to the solution. The movement is achieved by accumulating knowledge and skill, isn't it so? And when you got that logical problem, you isolate the problem, you set up devices, techniques for solving it. Americans are so thoroughly technologized in this way of looking at it, that all human and social problems are in that way. You see? When you got a human or a social problem, whatever, like desegregation or anything else, what you have, it's obvious that this is a problem, it has a solution, and all we need is more knowledge and skillful techniques. Instead of machinery, these are all American phrases, you recognize them? Instead of machinery for this. And human or social problem, machinery means an interlocking system of committees. But all of life is seen technologically. And that creates an intensely optimistic, or that articulates, doesn't create, articulate an intensely optimistic view of life. This is, I think, goes back to the 18th century. It is not the 20th century, because of the tremendous growth of technology, or the success of technology. In the 19th, 20th century, it has become self-evident and true to America that the question is to mark yourself as reactionary. Now, as a matter of fact, you know about the ideological problems, they are not solvable. The bishop never does patch them up and hope to forget about them. And the whole technological attitude is disastrous when you deal with human and social problems. But this is an ingrained conviction of Americans, and that's what articulates our incredible optimism. This, of course, has immediate religious bearing on religion. Americans are convinced that they have a technique for American, religious Americans, American church were convinced, and still are a lot of them, in large measure, convinced they have a technique, a kind of a technology for building the kingdom. When we get to Protestantism and the revivalist movement, we'll see how it works.
Isn't this changing now, dude?
Yes. It's changing for some segment of the population. It's certainly changing for theologians. It's changing for philosophers and social philosophers, social commentators, historians. But how far the change has penetrated American consciousness, mass consciousness, is a question. This leads in the present world to an incredible incredible sense of frustration. We're faced with all these problems of a kind we've never faced before. We should be able, Americans are convinced, if we have the gumption, the knowledge and the gumption will solve them, and yet they're not solved. So you know what happens. It's either the more educated people say we have not enough knowledge, less educated people say we have not enough gumption, see. Therefore, we accumulate all kinds of interesting but irrelevant knowledge about this social problem, that social problem, all things that put in the what you might call technological verbiage, but we all knew.
There's a difference between saying it can be solved and saying it can be solved just by technology.
Well, I'm not aware of any. How else do you solve it? Goodwill? I mean, problem. How else would you solve it except if you say it can be solved, how else would you think of it? How would you imagine it being solved except by some kind of technique? Technology doesn't mean only, machines and factories. It means techniques of social adjustment, social adaptation, you see? Or anything. How else would you solve it? How would you solve it? I'm not speaking of God's problems. Well, obviously, to say a problem is solvable, we should set up a machinery of a solution. It doesn't have to be a machine, a physical machine, a factory. So maybe something like that. Well, the whole business of getting the most interesting. But a part of an incredible technological drive in America. Nobody yet knows what's going to happen. But they're for granted by America, just a very few. That is, if the clock is going, they'll be in the reach, don't you see? This attitude is changing. It's changing very strategy. They're small. America's small. And I think an influence not overpowering. The mass consciousness of Americans, how far change has penetrated there is a question, is a serious question. I don't think very far. It takes more than a few decades for a revolution in kind of mass consciousness of the kind we're talking about, which has been formed for centuries. Now, the third feature of the American ethos is pragmatic. The test for everything is that it work. Results are what counts. I need not stress or point out that the pragmatic strain in American in the American culture had a tremendous reflection in the American religion. But that brought this down too. The phrase "deeds are what count." Deeds, not creeds, was not invented by a soulless pragmatist, but by the great revivalists. deeds, not creeds. You see? The result of a covenant. Does it work? And I read passage after passage from the Bible and say, unless Christianity works, and said it's false. My work is meant to make better men. And this came in the end about Christianity was a technique of character building. You heard about it.
Yeah.
And if it doesn't work to build character, people will make pretty much the same kind of no good character they were before, then obviously it's false. You see the point here? Religion became, at the end of the 19th century, a technique for character building. It was so recommended everywhere. And still so recommended.
Sure. Are you saying that this is a reflection of the culture, or is the culture reflecting
the culture? Yeah, I pointed out before that the American way of culture was molded by religious heritage, and then this American way reacted upon the religion. And for our purposes, I said reflected in, you see. We'll have to see the reciprocal action. But to quite frankly, this was a feature of American religion before the American way was fully structured. Now, the fourth feature of the American ethos is its individualism. I don't mean here the high, the supreme value of the individual, the high value of the individual. I mean the do-it-yourself ideology, my call it. Self-reliance ideology. That if there's anything to be done, do it yourself. And anything you have to do, you can do yourself. Do it yourself. In fact, much of that religion has been called a do-it-yourself religion. Every problem is thrown back to the individual to solve by his own termination, character, goodwill. Now, obviously, it has a tremendous effect on our religion. No. All of the whole revival theology is a do-it-yourself theology. From Finney to Gray. The do-it-yourself theology. Here's what it is. Of course, we'll examine again from what he said. But the revivalist appeal reverses the classic Christian position, which is very opposite of yourself. The classic Christian position says you cannot do it yourself. And the more you try to do it yourself, the more you can get into it. That's the classic Christian position. Salvation is a work of grace, faith is a work of grace. I don't have to emphasize that a lot. The more you try to do it yourself, the worse life you get into. And the break really comes, the breakthrough really comes, you realize you can't do it yourself. And you come to a conclusion you can't do it yourself. This is curiously echoed in the rules of our hearts and ours. The beginning of redemption is when you realize you cannot do it yourself. But the whole revival theology says this, and Billy Graham, have faith and then. Have faith and then, you see? As though having faith was something you could accomplish by yourself by gritting your teeth and clenching your fists. You see, it reverses grace and faith. And this from the theology of divine grace, the theology of Pelagian, the theology of doing yourself. Have faith and then. And then grace will come to you, you see. Now this goes all the way from Finney to Gray. And it's so characteristic of American religion, so characteristic of American way of thinking and feeling, that it's a real wrench of the imagination to see this as a reverse of a classic Christian position. Any question on this? This is the fourth feature. The fifth feature is, and that's again, something we're so accustomed to we don't think about, the pluralistic character of the American ethos. Now, by pluralistic, it's a word we use constantly now, and it was actually never used until the 30-40 years ago. But what I mean by that is this. There is suspicion of any institution taking too much ground. above all the government. There's suspicion of any institution claiming too much authority, too much jurisdiction. There's a feeling that the right way to have a lot of them with limited jurisdictions, checking and balancing each other, which of course defies the American Constitution. The American Constitution was deliberately devised that the federal government is in conflict with state governments, the executive branch is in conflict with the legislative branch, and both are in conflict with the judicial branch, and so on. Now, while for the federal constitution, this was a well thought out philosophy, for most Americans, simply discomfort with any institution or anything taking in too much ground, taking too much authority, so that it isn't bound by something else, you see? A suspicion of that, a suspicion of the army conduct of the state that claims in principle to be competent everywhere, which is the normal way in which the continental state thinks of itself. Although, of course, it can't operate in every field because the resources are limited. But the general philosophy of the state is that the state is omnicompetent. This is unpalatable to Americans. Although they're perfectly willing to take whatever the state will give them, provided it doesn't diminish them in their own eyes, they will not recognize that this is a kind of excessive jurisdiction of the state. Farmers are perfectly willing to get all the federal aid they can, provided not given them a direct subsidy. That's interesting. If it's used to bolster prices so that they feel they're operating on a free market, even though the prices are deliberately contrived by the federal government, that's fine. The moment you give them that any aid, direct subsidy, they feel humiliated and diminished. Isn't that right? And then what? The farmers will rail against the extension of jurisdiction of the power of federal government without recognizing that the subsidy they're getting, that indirect subsidy, the sky subsidy they're getting, is precisely that. They'll appeal for restoration of the free market without recognizing that the free market they want to operate is not the free market in Birmingham, in Manchester, which is the market for wheat, the world market for wheat. But a free market deliberately contrived by the federal government to give them a higher price than their wheat would fetch in Manchester. You see what I mean here? Now this again has pervaded American religion. This notion of that the right thing to have is a lot of religious denominations coexisting with each other, each one entitled to its own right, but we don't want to cover too much ground, see? One of the bishops of Methodist Church, a very well-known bishop, a few days ago, you must have seen it. I'll say I forgot his name. He made a statement which is so astounding to a European. If he could, by a snap of the finger, make everybody a Methodist, he wouldn't do it. He wouldn't do it. You don't think there should be too many Methodists. Apparently, there aren't enough. Because there should be others, you see? In this way, he proved himself a true American. You see the point here? So a European, that makes, whether he's a believer or not believer, that makes no sense at all. Now, that's extraordinarily important in our survey of American religion, this feeling of pluralism, of diversity and pluralism. It's not a philosophy, except among a political scientist, but it's just a endemic feeling. Any questions on this? Now, the last feature of the ethos of the American way is its egalitarian spirit. Well, America is called social equality. Americans are embarrassed at recognizing inequalities, at inequalities that are brought to attention. For example, an American takes by an American town, a city, a small town or a city in America, that's small enough so that people know each other. The biggest man in town, when he comes to a service station, he gets his car taken care of and so on, he'll address the service attendant as Tom, And when in a certain sense, it shows too much deference to him, he'll feel uncomfortable. He'll feel quite pleased if he's addressed as Jim. Won't he? Most of you come from such communities, you know that. Now, he's not by any means deceiving himself, I mean, he's not higher in whatever to the social scale than the power. But he doesn't want the inequalities to be signalized, don't you see? To be brought to attention. American women are different. If his wife is around, he doesn't want the man to call him Mr. Bastard. But if the man calls him Jim, his wife comes back and says, what kind of business is this? You know? American women are very sensitive to social applications. And they want this to be signalized. American men are not. And they're embarrassed that they usually, what I call, recognize as signalizing the problems. Whereas in Europe, this is a part of social structure. You couldn't force a servant in Europe to treat his employer, master, in a way which the servant kind of will treat a man he knows is important as casual. You know, obviously, how he knows it. This is what we call the egalitarian strain in American ethos. Not so much that all men are equal in their social position which they manifest, they are not. You got all the way from the upper to the lower you know. But that within limits, not the upper. There's a difference there, even there, in the middle class, because it's permeated. But for the great mass of Americans, the recognition of this kind of social stratification is an embarrassment and a discomfort. You ask Americans, are they classes? You want me there or not? You ask Americans, what class do you belong to? Say the middle class. What class do your neighbors belong to? All the neighbors, he knows about middle class. There are some lower class people, but they're way down the wall somewhere, you know, out on the wall, you see? Because American life, the American society is highly stratified. It's fluid, but highly stratified. But there is a discomfort at the formal recognition of these inequalities. Yes,
I wonder if you saw that film several years ago. I believe it was the title Sabrina, which dealt with a very wealthy family.
Yes.
And there was one scene in which the chauffeur was driving the older brother to his office, and the older brother is trying to get chummy with the chauffeur, and the chauffeur was bossing.
He could not violate the no state's dignity.
Exactly.
That's the European attitude.
Fine, you're a snob.
That's right. Said
the chauffeur.
Right. And at the time, I mean, Americans are frightened more than anything else of being of seeing themselves as snobs, of being seen as snobs. And it's the European trained servant in the American family that are the snobs. Yes?
I understand in this stratification that religious leaders are most always seen as part of this great middle class.
Yes.
Is this a part of the...
Yes. I don't know of any religious leader seen as a part of the upper class. The upper is really a small class in America. It's a very old families in old towns. The old family on the hill, you know, there's an old white house there in Olson, 18th century. The old family on the hill. They're probably poor too, you know. But they're upper. But upper upper is a very small class in America. It corresponds to the European aristocracy. And America once had a size of aristocracy, but they were destroyed during the Civil War period by industrialization and Civil War. Very little respect.
Has the mobility of the class structure changed since the cessation of immigration?
Since when?
The cessation of immigration.
No, it has hard, it's not hard. That's good. We were led to believe that it was hard, but it's not hard. It's not hard at all. There is tremendous mobility now because of new industry, because of geographic mobility, you know. 1,600 people come to California every single day. Every single day of the year, 1,600 people enter California. With a mobility like that, everything is rather constant fluid, you see.
Well, listen there, we're talking about an individual basis, but I'm thinking in the South, we recognize inequality and segregation. Now, the bank president pulled up to the gas station, and a white attendant took his car. We argued calling him.
But not another. That's right. Because remember, we took out the racial stratification, remember that? That's a very different thing. That introduced a caste-like feature in American life. We'll start to say something about it later. You're quite right, it's an ugly outside picture. And until recently, Negro was not called Mr. You could call him doctor or professor or bishop or whatever, you could call him Mr. Because Mr. is kind of the source of equality, you see? Any other question here? Now, the third level, I would call the cultural aspect of the American way. And you begin with a strange paradox. There is an intense faith in education in America, the highest possible valuation of education, and a disparagement of culture. Now let's examine both of these. There is not only the highest possible valuation of education, I would say that if you make a list of the tenets of the American creed, that's come up very hard. First three or four. The high valuation of education and an intense faith in education. Education is for everybody and it's for everybody. Now, this is not characteristic of the 18th century. Jefferson, who was the most, we will say, democratic of the founding fathers, certainly, had a very different scheme of education. Everybody was going to receive a common school education. For years, though, learn how to read and write and count. The writer students were going to receive a secondary education. And only a tiny handful of the natural leaders would receive a college education. Not Jefferson's scheme, the pyramid. Nobody would dream of this kind of all education for everybody. But this changed somewhere. For the high school, it changed in the 19th century. For the college, it changed after the Second World War, over the Second World War. But today, it's taken to be one of the natural rights guaranteed by the Declaration of Independence of the Constitution that you must have a college diploma. That's easy enough, you see. If you're a man, if you're a woman, all you have to do is go to that college, don't need a diploma. If you don't have it, you're cheated. You're not a criminal. Somebody has cheated. That's what you're saying. This is so unprecedented in America or in the world. And that needs attention. And again, America's good education is good for everything. Anything at all can be solved by education. So, American schools have become litter bags of every variety of skills. I work with your mother in the kitchen. Your mother taught me how to cook. Mother taught me how to cook. Now, school. That was all over the line.
What about education that isn't institutionalized? Self-education.
Well, the Americans don't know what I mean. You mean the adult education, the great book selection?
The person who reads a lot, but who has to have much.
Well, in early American life, he was a very important character. The self-educated farmer who read Greek classics and But in modern America, this is the concept of the reality. Well, it isn't the amount of learning you have, it's the social status conferred by having gone to college. You see, it doesn't do any good. Self-education means nothing at all. Although in the early days, in the 18th century, self-educated farmers, the farmer was a very important character in American life. And was read highly regarded about the newspaper and so on. Now this high value on education, this high value on conferred education, or this intense faith in education, has nothing is standing in an apparent paradox to American contempt for disparagement of culture, which is high value. Now, I say this is an apparent paradox, it's not a real paradox. How do you link these two together? To an untutored European, all Europeans come to America, completely untutored, they're see. You don't know what to make of this. It seems strange, Americans are fanatical about education. They spend more on education per head than two European countries put together. Any two European countries choose them, and put them together, Americans spend more education per capita. And this reminds me, have some of you have seen Open End with Bill Buckley and Draw It Out? Anybody seen it? Well, you didn't miss very much of that. Yeah, I'm a certified liberal, you know, of the simple mind schools. In his view, the trouble in the case of America was class are too big, the buildings are too old, we don't put enough money into it. And he said, look at France, but look at splendid education, children get France. Now France probably is best, but I mentioned education in France is probably more demanding and more intense anywhere in the Western world, But it never occurred to him to look at a French schoolhouse, which is generally an old hut broken down to pieces. It never occurred to him to ask why the average class in France, in elementary school in France, sits the problem. But he was ranting already at 25 years in Rex American education. Another example of another guy, you see. By education, they mean these shining facilities, which give us social status, you see. Now, why is there no contradiction between, or no real contradiction between, this intense faith in education, this intense valuation, high valuation of education, and the disparagement, contemptible disparagement of culture? And when you understand this, you'll understand the curious structure of American culture. I'm using culture to live in sense, now, notice it. I think of American culture, I usually have a college there, does. I say high, a contemptible culture, I mean the high culture, literary and artistic and scientific and so on.
I would guess because of the goal of education to make money or to increase technology.
The goal of education isn't to make money, although the education helps make money. The goal of education is to confer status. To move the son of a kind of vegetable dealer who's lower middle class, then one generation up to middle class, or if you marry right, you're upper middle class. That's the goal of, that's the purpose of education, you see?
Could there be connected with their fear of
snobbery?
Could there be what?
With their fear of snobbery, fear of being snobbed? Yes, that's right. Fear of being snobbed. Now look. Education for Americans means mass education for everybody. But culture is an aristocratic word. You cannot have culture in a country of mass equality. It's a problem. And Americans are therefore, how might I say it, instinctively right when they are mad about education, but hostile to culture.
So there's a belief here not only that everybody should start out, but that everybody should end up.
That's right. That's right. That I was living this, they should end up. That's right. That's right. And if he doesn't end up the same way, today it's college. It's a college education. He has been cheated. Wasn't a fair and it wasn't a celebration at all, it's because the rewards are already assigned. But it's a cheat. But you see, culture is intrinsically anti-democratic. Meaning democratic in this sense of mass equality.
This isn't so in Europe.
Oh, yes, it is so. In Europe, they have culture and are very moderate about education.
Well, I mean, the great mass of people don't feel alienated from the arts and culture.
That's right. But you have a stratified society. And you have a stratified society where people look to the aristocracy, the traditional aristocracy, for natural leadership. You see? In America, nobody looks anymore for natural leadership. There aren't any natural leaders. There were in the past, and I'm not. Everybody's equal in that situation. Culture. When you have a aristocratic society, and it's not born with the violent revolution. The great mass of the middle class, not the lower class, but the middle class, look to the aristocracy for the definition of values. But in America, everybody looks to his neighborhood definition of values. You see? And what you have is a totalitarian society in which culture is impossible. Except for a tiny handful of people who are outside of it. Societies are part of it. They're recognized as culture bearers.
Is there a contradiction here with the use of foundation money that is money that was made by the great industrialists, used now to subsidize or sort of patronize, create, or?
Yeah, but very little is used that way. Most of it is used in natural sciences or in social sciences for technological progress. I'm about 55, 7 days to do that. The policy's now, but most Americans shrug. And not half-headed, but you remember when Kennedy had a state dinner for Nobel Prize winners, you remember that thing? We're all the way down for payments. That's characteristic of American promiscuity, you see. Do you know how this hurt him in public image? That he was advised by, those who feel the population that would get that vaccine again? This hurt him. He did not come to the opening of Philharmonic in New York. Exactly. And you see why? That's all right for her. Of course, it was a woman's business. He was hurt by it. I wouldn't say hurt. He hurt bad. Worse. But it did not help him. In the American picture. A president who gets into this kind of long hair thing does not have confidence in the nation. The nation will lose confidence. Any questions? Now, a word, something more on culture, for that's so important. America was not always like this. Before the Civil War, there were two aristocracies in America, and there was a high culture developed. There was a southern aristocracy and a plantation on the mainland. You see, culture required aristocracy and leisure. And there was a high culture developed. And then in New England, the mercantile agrarian aristocracy, the Indians, a high culture developed. And culture was a man's business. Although women began, women already in 1830s and 40s began hustling in, into novel writing things. But poetry was written by men, and novels written by men, and music was told by men. Well, the man's business was appreciated by men.
But the Southern culture, really, that's
deep. No, not deep, but hard. Okay, by now,
the question is very superficial.
Well, and if you're in the service, superficial doesn't define very much. Suppose it touches 1/10 of 1% of people. That's more. And you're 1/10%, 1/10 of 1%. It's a real culture. I doubt culture was anything. Yeah, that's a law that's so clear in that sense. That is, on the surface, the great mass of culture, you see. But in any case, it is true for two reasons. First, there were so many poor whites and, of course, slaves in the South. And because the South was, instead of the pink magnolia that last picture, was a bustling, on the basis of the oldest thing, not the South Carolina and Virginia, but Mississippi, but then would be regarded as frontier states, you see. Well, really, states on making and the businessman ideology dominated. But there was a culture, we know, and the history of American literature will show you that. And New England, you know, New England, the culture signified by the animals, which is not the military. But these two aristocracies were destroyed, both were destroyed in the very act of the Civil War. The South, by the collapse, the destruction of Southern society, on which this was based, and by the frenetic anxiety of the next generation of Southerners to be as like as much like the Yankees as possible, and immigrate. So Yankee out of the South. That came in the 1870s and 1880s, you see. They must have had Yankee eyes. The Southern aristocracy was destroyed. And whether the remnants of it simply slipped back into ignominy, we won't see. In New England, what destroyed New England aristocracy? Not Civil War, but not the destruction of Civil War, what destroyed New England aristocracy? Two great forces which came simultaneously. One? Yeah, that's right, industrialization and immigration. Industrialization simply destroyed the old conservative mercantile agricultural aristocracy. And of course, immigration wiped them out of politics. Of course, they became an Irish citizen, not a Yankee citizen. Cambridge became an Irish citizen, not a Yankee citizen, you see? But that, and then the overall fact of both sides is that after the war, the country began expanding at a tremendous, incredible rate, industrially, economically, and it was like a great barbecue. You had to rush to it to get your slice of it, but its minds were fixed on making money. This kind of case was case then. I'm making money, because money was being made all over. And politics and business became a mandate. While the fine things of life, which were of course not wiped out completely, became a woman's affair. Do you recognize that? This was the age in which women's literary societies sprang up, Brown Society, this kind of society, that kind of society, good literary society. Women became the bearers of culture for the entire community, and that of course meant the feminization of culture. Men would see touching this and that of hope. You see? That's what happened in the last half of the 19th century. That's the source, that's the secret for what you might call the anti-intellectualism of Americans, or something like that, intellectualism. This anti-culturalism, but better word, this feeling that culture is snobbish in a woman's appearance. Now, women are permitted, they're licensed snob, they're not meant to be snob. A man who comes to fight golf tells us he's snob, but he doesn't really mean it. He wants to be snob, you see? Therefore, these snobs think that better for women. But not men. You follow the point here? Now, this had a tremendous effect on religion. All this will come up again, I will point out. America really became a woman's affair. Only in two places, except for the older immigrant church like that before, where they had a woman in. Let alone, come front. But the more American churches, as it became the more American, more middle class American, more suburban American, they came, really became a woman's affair. Why? Because of the design of the final things of life, isn't it? And the final things of life are preserved with women. That really became a woman's affair. And only two areas that men show themselves, in the finances and the men's club. Do you recognize that? But a long history, a long and complex history. I don't have the highlights. You see? It's impossible to say about religion you might think superficial aspects without knowing the history of our culture, without understanding how American religion emerges out of the culture that is to start development. Any questions? Any questions? Now, I said intense faith education, a hard evaluation of education, mass education. You know what I mean by that? I mean mass education. I don't mean high education. There is always an antithesis between high and mass. You say, therefore, high goes without a superficial identity. Those who see everything and master glory about high as position. Well, naturally, it's way up there, it's all the way down here. Along with a disparagement of culture, a snobbish and effeminate. It was all right for Jackie Kennedy to go to the Philharmonic, but it would have been a great era for the festival.
Why was it certainly all right for Mayor Wagner and Governor Rockefeller?
It's a sensibility. It's a serious sensibility. They opened the Americana. They go there. Were they there? If they opened, let's say, an enormous door panel, wouldn't they be there? It's a serious sensibility. And it's going to be a great economic battle with the city. You know that mistake. Well, that's obvious. Now, any questions? The next feature in the cultural art of Americans, and again, I mentioned it before, but I want to stress it again, is that high moral valuation placed upon sanitation and cleanliness. I've already discussed that, remember, the notion. How the notion of murder and cleanliness is next to godliness, and how least it is. Americans regard cleanliness, sanitation, along with efficiency, getting things done, as high moral virtues. Now, this shows something in what may appear to you to be, when you come to it, amazing ways, although we don't know. Americans in Europe, I don't mean tourists who are always and get everything, but I mean American soldiers when they're there. What people in Europe do they like best? You're closest to?
Germans.
Their enemies. Whom do they like least?
French.
French.
In French.
Their allies.
Oh, crazy allies, well, that way. Why did I like the German so well?
They
didn't say values. They didn't say
values. They're
people, you know. They're people. The French are dirty and inefficient. They're not people. You see? Well, they have a long time. It's only because you realize this. Everyone knows this. Well, this is directly due to this. Directly, it comes out of this, culinary class of Americans.
Does the fact that Americans no longer wear beards, for instance, have to do with cleanliness?
As what?
The fact that beards are no longer popular, does this have to do with...
No, that's not something foreign. Not beards, it's a cycle of beards. I think I meant the paper. English, and we'll put it back on this, English preceded the Americans in this. The 19th century, everybody was making fun of the Englishmen who carried along a zinc bathtub, a glacial bathtub, where we found in Europe. We don't think it's so funny that we could get a bathtub in Europe for a little money. You go to a French hotel, so not now, now for St. Martin's and American tourists, and they have bathtubs. But that's great. You're going to have time to find something in Rome in order to get a bathtub in bathtub. But in the 19th century, you could go to the best hotel that ever had any bathtub at all. Hey, we have public road private. You want to take a bath? You're an irresistible urge. Englishmen carry around their glasses and bathtubs. And the French, the Continentals, the French spend it. We're all making fun of them. And they make fun of Americans now. When an American goes into a French hotel room, and a hotel, but he's given a hotel suite, what does he do first? What does he look at first? The what? Almost an upset, he goes back to the downstairs. That seems incredibly insane. Now, this is so universal among us that we don't think it's odd. And you'll see how it entered into American religion. responsibility.
This lasted right to the 1880s. The first president of the United States that did not have a full beard was Chester Arthur, who wore a very slightly mustache, a bit, you see. And Cleveland, who wore a mustache. But even that disappeared. Roosevelt was hero for the last president who wore a mustache. McKinley already could shave him. And not every single president could shave him. It has very little, it has a strange cycle of beards. And I had the only 18th century, I had to go back. Romans were all clean shaven until the 2nd and 3rd century. Romans, all Roman emperors were clean shaven, and all Romans of any substance. Well, here are the favorite guy of the temple, defended by Romans. The 3rd century, they began to grow a light beard to frame the face. Well, this is strictly irrelevant. Is the extraordinary confidence in utilitarians. In labor-saving devices, what's going on there, though, it's a question of how much labor they save, whether it's worth saving the labor. Because then you save all the labor of a house by running the door at that. She has a serious cultural and technological crisis because her time is empty. And the mistake to think that making bread is a waste of time, making bread is a part of an integral way of life. And many young women are not trying to go back to making bread, you know, in a kind of amateurish way. But this feeling of get things done quick. We want a new utility, new machine, and this and this, without consideration of what they do. It's about doing faster. Is so characteristic in American way, and it's a part of Americanization. Everybody calls this Americanization. Most of these call Americanization. Mass education was called in England the Americanization of education. Everywhere. These are all for the European world, these appear to be perfectly clear aspects of the American way. Now, any questions? And when people criticize Americans for being a European or foreign, Americans for being materialistic, either they completely misunderstand the American, either they be materialistic in the way of expensive materialistic and money grubber, which Americans are not, or they mean this extraordinary fixation on mechanical utilities, on shiny mechanical utilities. Now that should not be, that should be a kind of fetishism rather than a kind of materialism. It's not materialism in any sense. So that I also have this impression on my religion, which will all be obvious to you just by thinking about it. But you see what it has done. It has evacuated for women, especially middle class housewives, evacuated the normal natural content of their lives. So having got all the utilities, they have to save their labor, they now have to wonder what they'll do with the same labor. Now you can't help but go read great books. to be more natural and do that.
Isn't there also, though, this seems to me, at least in suburban communities in many areas, that it's not really clear cut that a suburban woman who has these labor saving devices is also involved a lot more, let's say, with the children in schools and clubs,
yes.
Extracurricular activities.
That's right. That's right.
That she has other things that sort of move in.
Like something, of course.
Sometimes they're really busier than they were before.
Yes. Well, I can meet that nothing. I say it's a problem now. I'll go to the top. I don't mean I'll go to the top. There's another point, too, though. In suburban, while the gadgets must be shiny and new, look at the ads inside of U-Club or anywhere else. As a favorite word or the terms, it's always new, new, new. All right, new, everything. The suburban life flood up rooted and made mobile in a way they can't even deserve, the shift from here to there and so on, want to establish the appearance of roots, of belonging where they are. And therefore, they try to establish the externals of race, age. You build a new as you have on that street there, you know, on that there, you know. New houses, the new building development, the new housing development there. The generals and rich there, they're put in there to look old. There's a big industry in America taking new bricks and making them old. See, this has gone so far, this new, that people have become so thoroughly rooted they can't live. Therefore, in some aspects of urban life, they want to establish a feeling of old belonging. And this was burned too. They'll get colonial pictures on the walls, portraits in the 1830s and 40s, you know, and they feel there's an old homestead. So we get to the brand new brick at the door.
Your
package came
now, they're like the old
recipes
of the South.
Yes, yes. Like, and they're written in the, they're printed in the times that makes them look oldish, you know? That's right. Now, this is an effect on Parliament, because you don't have the friends that got the topic. It was published over here. Any questions? And the last, well, not the last, the fourth segment is political economics. We'll begin on this. I think on a political economic level, the American way is to express a democracy. But politically, democracy for the American means the Constitution. Now the Constitution has become, it was always, but has become one of the most extraordinary sacred symbols of American life. You can't have a conflict of Americans in which both sides, well, there are three sides, four sides, five sides, in which they all, in which, and you can't have a conflict of America in which they're very competitive sides without all equally appealing to the Constitution. It's impossible. They can get any happiness in that. Both sides appeal to the Constitution. And quite sincerely and quite vehemently they appeal to the Constitution. The Constitution is the keystone of the whole political social structure of America. It is itself an untouchable. It is itself beyond any human any human tampering. The Constitution has been amended many, many times, but the American modern Constitution, it was so it was, so it is, so it will be. It's an unchangeable reality. If I can mock anyone,
yeah,
the same thing. It's about the Constitution. I know a fellow who calls it the Bible Constitution. Yeah, well, that's worked it backwards. You see, the Constitution is so sacred, they want the Bible here and sacred, they're giving that name, you see. Now, there are, this was not only the case, the abolitionists in America, the fanatical wing of the, in the North, and called the Constitution a compact with the devil. You see? Europe, France has many constitutions as, well, they've got now It's the seventh country, the fifth republic, they've got several monarchies and two imperial regimes. And now they're going to change countries again. Constitution is not regarded with any stability or any importance in the Czech Republic's mind. Not at all. They have no reference to Constitution. Constitution was changed by the Gaulle, they came in, it'll be changed again now, and whatever the Constitution means has no symbolic reference or any friendship at all. In England, it has. In England, the Constitution is a tradition, not a written document. And it's closely associated with the Royal House. Parliament. House of Commons. You know what I mean? Well, this is so happens to Americans. Now, you may say that the primary political symbol for Americans that holds everything else together is the Constitution. That also has some of this repercussion when we get there. The second, I would say, is free enterprise, which means freedom and equality of opportunity. And I pointed out, even those farmers who live by the subsidies given the federal government insist that they establish free enterprise in agriculture. Free enterprise is not an economic value for Americans, it is a moral value. Well, we'll complete the discussion of the American way next session. And then go on to the relationship to religion, one direction or the other.